From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Most of the time, when David K. Johnston's here, I know exactly where I want to start. The investigative journalist and Pulitzer Prize winner sharing an hour with us. We always have a lot to talk about. Today, I confess, there is so many places we could go with David K. that I think I'm going to let him tell us what he thinks about what we saw last night. If you're just sort of waking up to what happened last night, it was a rather remarkable Republican wave across the country. They took control of the U.S. Senate in New York State. They took control of the state Senate. We've been talking about the policy ramifications of that here in New York State. It looks like campaign finance is probably dead for a while. We're looking at the women's equality agenda and whether those individual items will have to be pulled apart now because gridlock looks likely on the 10th point, which is abortion. So there's a lot of questions about policy. I invited David Kay on because we wanted to talk about some of his recent work in looking at safety nets, the impact of safety nets, and disparity, wage disparity, who actually is making more. We're going to get to that, but can I ask you first what you made of it last night?
Well, the most important thing, of course, is that the great majority of Americans didn't vote. So, you know, we are a nominal democracy. Only about 40% of the eligible voters actually turned out to vote. And even with that, we had have a massive effort underway to suppress the vote. You know, in Georgia, 40,000 applications to vote just disappeared. And the state says, gee, we can't find them. We don't know what happened to them. In Florida, in Texas, clear, absolutely unchallengeable on the notion that these are designed to make sure that we overstate white voting. And a long history of this, especially in Texas. I'm astonished that the Democrats, and I'm a registered Republican, that the Democrats poured all this money into television. $4 billion was spent on these elections nationwide of all kinds. An enormous amount of on television where the very highest rates are paid. When much more cheaply, they could have simply worked hard to get the vote out, to hire people, to drive people to the polls. And I think a big reason for that is that to many, many Americans, what government does at all levels is just doesn't seem relevant to their lives. They don't feel that they have a sense of personal power and their vote makes a difference.
When you look at the North Carolinas, the states that have looked at, say, identification, voter ID and whatnot, the issue I have is if you can point to actual fraud, actual issues, then I'm open to the notion that maybe we need to be more restrictive in who we allow to vote. When you actually sift through the evidence, it is not even flimsy. It's
right.
Not there.
Right. In the Pennsylvania case where the courts ruled that they could not proceed with the law that they had, the proponents of voter ID, whose whole case was built on fraud, acknowledged in what's called a stipulation, that's an agreed facts by both sides, that there was no known case of voter fraud in the entire state of Pennsylvania. This is a phony issue. And it goes actually to the things that I've been writing about mostly lately. I'm doing a new column for somebody else today, and the opening line of it is, what's the matter with America? Off of Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yes.
People are voting against their economic interests, but the reason is that they actually don't know. Unless you read my columns, you don't know what's actually going on with upward redistribution, with falling wages except for one group of Americans and their numbers are shrinking, with the growing number of people high up in the food chain who are living tax-free. Because there's no official statistics on this, I have to go cull all the – well, there are statistics. I have to analyze them. And on the upward redistribution of the gifts, there are no statistics, as opposed to we have very detailed on what do we do for the sick, the elderly, the poor, for children.
When it comes to, by the way, to Kansas, Mr. Frank went to Kansas recently to find out what is still the matter with Kansas.
Went home to Kansas.
Well, yeah, I should say, wanted to sort of pose the question in the 2014 context right before the election, because there was a lot of thought that Senator Roberts would lose and that Governor Brownback, who got into office as governor and said, if we slash taxes, you're going to see this state take off like an engine. He didn't say it will take some time. Give
right.
it time to build. He said this will be rocket fuel for the state's economy.
Right.
It has not worked out that way, but he wins a narrow re-election. Roberts wins a narrow re-election. So there's no penalty for that.
Well, there's no penalty if voters lack fundamental information. Kansas, has been slashing spending on education. That's fundamentally a decision to be poorer in the future when Governor Brownback will be long out of office. The state's job growth has been just awful. That isn't to say that what we're doing now in any way is something is right or the right way to do things, but the conversation we're having is not rooted in facts. And, you know, the founders of this country, they were the aristocrats of the United States. They were well-educated. They knew the classics. They were well-read. And they believed in reason. And now you have all these absolutely crazy claims going, you know, this was founded as a Christian nation. Right. That's why the Constitution says in Article 10, there shall be no religious test for any office, and why many of the founders were deists. And of course, Thomas Jefferson famously wrote a book he never published in which he de-deified Jesus. You know, we have a whole lot of Americans who are just really badly informed about what's going on. And I think if you listen to, for example, Fox News, and we know that people who listen to Fox News when they're subjected to independent inquiry turn out to be incredibly badly informed, worse informed than people who say they have no regular news source. If you listen to the nonsense there, then, of course, the way you see people voting would make sense because you're being told things that you believe and expect to be true, even though it's very simple to verify whether they are or not.
There is a religious test, by the way. You can be a Jedi and have a better chance to get into office than if you are an atheist, but that's the religious test.
Yes. Yeah.
But if you want to talk to David K. Johnston and about any of these issues, and again, we can go in many different ways, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let me grab Don in East Rochester. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon, Mr. Johnson. Your comment there about less than half of the population, less than half the electorate voted in yesterday's election, that reminds me of something my father told me when I was in high school 45 years ago. Every American should be concerned and should monitor and observe what their government does because they have the power to do everything from determine how much you're going to pay in taxes to whether you go to war or not. The poor and the working class need to at least vote. I would prefer to see them do much more outside of the electoral system, but to at least vote because they are the ones that are going to be paying the higher taxes. They are likely to be the ones that are going to be going off to fight for wars. We need to get involved in our system.
Yeah, this is, you know, a perpetual problem in America. The founders, during the time we were breaking away from the British, wrote all sorts of articles you can go back and read and gave speeches complaining about the apathy of the public and their difficulties in rousing the public. When polling, well-done polls that ask good questions and test by asking multiple questions that are, approach the same issue from different perspectives are done, they show that the vast majority of Americans favor higher taxes on the very highest earners, closing corporate loopholes, less military spending, and expanding Social Security. 73% of Republicans. 73% of Republicans want to increase Social Security benefits. But that's not what you see in the results because the people who actually vote are a subset, and they tend to be wealthier and better off. And we make it difficult for people to vote. The average waiting time in the 2012 election for white Americans at the polls was 12 minutes. For Hispanics, it was 19 minutes. For black Americans, it was 24 minutes, according to research reported on yesterday by Stephanie Mensimer.
But voting isn't the only thing that the American public can do. We can be out in the street demanding that these things happen. We can demand. Four of the most conservative states in the nation just yesterday voted to raise their minimum wages.
Right.
That was very surprising to me. We need to vote, but we need to do more than vote. We need to go out and demand these things. We need to understand the issues, and we need to go out and demand, depending on what benefits us. And 99% of us are working class people, and whatever is going to enhance the welfare and the power of the working class needs to be addressed.
Don, thanks for the call. David, he's mentioned minimum wage. Looking at Arkansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, and an expected minimum wage increase in Alaska. Those four states yesterday saying yes to increasing the minimum wage. But here you have Marianne Levine writing with Timothy Noah in Politico saying across the country, it doesn't have that much of a coattail effect. And the question is, can the White House and can Democrats use the minimum wage to their effect in elections? But now you've got some red states going in that direction. What do you make of that, David?
Well, what I make of it is that the plutocrat class, or the segment of it that's only interested in itself, that's not all rich people, but some of the very rich and who are very politically involved, believe that the road to their greater prosperity is driving down wages. And so they do all sorts of sophisticated things to persuade other people that either it doesn't matter or it's bad for the economy. It doesn't matter what the studies and the facts and the empirical data show. One of my columns, I write a column every week for Al Jazeera America, which has turned out to be the most professional, first-rate news organization I've ever worked for. I mean, the New York Times could take lessons from them on how to do things. I went through and analyzed in three columns the latest wage data, the 2013 wage data. And one of the things that I showed, let me go back 1 year to 2012, because that's the column I have in front of me, and this ran just a couple of weeks ago, August 11th, I guess, a couple of months ago. The lowest paid workers, those who made less than $20,000 a year, saw their average pay go up between 2000 and 2012 by more than the rate of inflation. They got a small but real wage increase. And I show that's entirely explained by President George W. Bush signing into law three increases in the minimum wage that the vast majority of Republicans in the Senate and 82 Republicans in the House voted for. Now, many of those politicians now are saying, we need to get rid of the minimum wage. A minimum wage sets a minimal standard. If you're going to argue we shouldn't have a minimum wage, I think journalists should ask questions like, well, do you think then that we should have people work for free? Should we bring back the ancient world, not the American world, but the ancient world concept of slavery and let people sell themselves into slavery?
Child labor.
Child labor. Should we go back and get rid of our child labor laws? And the amount of welfare that we have to spend that is, in fact, an indirect subsidy to massive employers who pay the minimum wage, like McDonald's and Walmart. You know, Walmart collects about $6.8 billion through its workers of welfare, food stamps, child care subsidies, and other benefits. The economy would be more efficient and more effective if we got rid of those. But we also have to, therefore, have a serious discussion where people spend some time understanding what this data is. And I find it atrocious that the federal government and the state governments collect a massive amount of data that tell us about every penny that goes to the disabled and children and the poor and the elderly, but they don't collect any data. Literally, no data is collected. You have to pry it from the public record on the $70 billion a year, that's $225 per person, that we're giving to corporations per person in America. $900 a year for a family of four is more than the average weekly take-home income of a family of four in America. And the $1.1 trillion of various tax expenditure favors the federal government allows, and how, last point, the multinational corporations now all literally turn a profit off of their taxes. And you can read my Newsweek cover story from September called Corporate Deadbeats, in which Warren Buffett brags about his $57 billion interest-free loan from the government.
If you're waiting to talk to David K. Johnston and every phone line is now filled up, look what you've done, David. We will get
I'll
to you.
Down.
No. Be patient if you're on the phone. We'll get to you. But on the notion of corporate welfare, Joe Spector for Gannett wrote a piece last month in which he talked about the fact that New York State by far leads the nation in essentially in corporate welfare. And to you, that was no surprise.
Right.
But again, every year we have this debate about whether the state's spending to spur, you know, to stimulate, that's what it's sort of disguised as, or some will say spent in earnest to try to stimulate.
But what the state's really doing in the programs they have in Monroe County is a big center of this, is damaging locally owned entrepreneurial businesses. I once got the county to give me all the hotel tax records, and I adjusted for inflation and changes in the tax rate. We've had the same number of hotel rooms sold in this county since 1990. It's about a 2% variance every year. And what is the county government doing? It's putting up money for new hotels. Well, the message in that, when your tax dollars go to these hotels, is that they're going to destroy the business of some of the existing hotels. If it's a sound investment, the market will finance it. Why should you as a taxpayer be forced to put money into a business? That's not market capitalism. It's not what the Republicans in particular say that they believe in. And it is destructive of local wealth and local ownership. You know, I mean, all across the country, we have Walmart stores, Lowe's, Home Depot's, entire shopping centers, Cabela's and Bass Pro's that are built with your tax dollars. Why? Why? There's no indication that it creates jobs. In fact, I've shown that in New York State, we spent $1.7 billion on subsidies over a period of years. I don't remember how many years it was. I think it was a five-year period. And the net result was the loss of jobs, 57,000 jobs. Now, Tom DiNapoli put out a report saying we created all these jobs because he accepted the argument of the people who were the employers about the number of people they'd hired and ignored, and he's basically the state's chief accountant, ignored the offsets, the losses at other employers. You want to have a more vibrant economy and lower taxes, we've got to stop taking money out of the pockets of a lot of people to hand it over to the pockets of the already rich.
Here's the next part of that debate, though, David, comes with this. If every state in the country said, we're not going to do this, we're not going to subsidize corporations, we're not going to pick winners and losers, we're not going to give huge credits to big box stores, sort of injuring the competitive balance, especially in small communities. If every state did that, then you could restore sort of a competitive playing field. If New York State said, look, this isn't really working, and they sort of stood alone on this, then everybody tells me, whether it's the business community or state legislators, they tell me, we can't be the only one.
That's everybody's operative assumption, and I agree with you, that's the assumption, and all of this goes to something in the Constitution known as the Dormant Commerce Clause. I think it would be interesting if we could get one state to take a principled stand, because I suspect they would find things would work out just fine. But somebody's got to have the courage to run against it. And of course, in business, how do you make a fortune? Find something the market needs that isn't being provided and provide it. Well, you know, we have a state constitution that absolutely prohibits gifts of money or even credit to corporations. Approved by the voters by 2-to-1 margins in the 1840s, the 1870s, the 1930s, and by reverse in the 1960s. And what does our state's highest court say? It's true. The Constitution says we may not give money or credit to corporations, but the legislature can give the money to an agency which will hand over the money to the corporations. You know, I would impeach the senior judge of the court over that very issue. I think that's just an outrageously inappropriate reading of our Constitution, where the voters have spoken clearly.
Well, when it comes to what the state does decide to spend, it doesn't look like we're headed for any sort of a pullback at all. In fact, a Republican who won a seat in the state Senate last night, former broadcaster Rich Funke, at his victory speech, I want to listen to a portion of it because I had a little bit of cognitive dissonance here. He's talking about smaller government, more efficient government, less spending, but then, by God, we need $1 billion like Buffalo. Let's listen to Rich Funke.
It's time for us Republicans to deliver a unified message about creating smaller, more accountable, more affordable government in this country and in this state. And in the 55th Senate District, it'll be about jobs. It'll be about workforce development. It'll be about property and business tax relief. It'll be about getting our fair share of school aid and economic development aid. If Buffalo got $1 billion, by God, we better be next in line.
I find it interesting that Mr. Funke, who used to be a journalist, didn't talk, as best I can tell, to any journalist during the campaign, would not submit himself to questioning by anybody who's competent to examine what he has to say. And I think we should be very concerned about anybody who runs for office who is unwilling to submit themselves to questioning by people whose job is to know how to frame questions that should make you uncomfortable. All politicians should face tough, hard questions. In Funke's case, I can reconcile the seeming inconsistency there. What he's saying is that to the extent that money is being spent by the state, I want to make sure Rochester gets its fair share, but I want
essentially what Peter Lawrence said last hour.
In the last hour, that's right. But nonetheless, it's still an incoherent message. And notice, totally absent from that message is, well, what is the public investment that is required to produce a wealthy, healthy, stable society? That's not his beginning assumption. By his own words, his beginning assumption is less. And maybe we need more. I mean, we need to discuss seriously where we need more and where we need less.
All right. David mentioned that the president, the previous president, George W. Bush, signing minimum wage increases into law impacted earning from 2010 to 2012, right?
2000 to 2012.
2000 to 2012. But you write for Al Jazeera English.
Al Jazeera America.
Al Jazeera America. I'm looking at the corner, the section there. Al Jazeera America on October 23rd. Compensation shrinks for all income groups with one exception. What did you find in 2013? What did you find?
The federal government breaks down wages, salaries, what's on your W-2 form, into 60 categories from $1 to $5,000, and the top categories over $50 million. The only group that went up was over $50 million. That group's average income went up about 10%, $11 million a year. But the number of people in that group shrunk from 160 down in 2012 down to 110. And I'd previously shown from the same data for 2012 that we are facing a continuing downward drift in wages and salaries, that is compensation to labor. And it is the core of our economic problems is that people are being paid less money. And they're being paid in inefficient ways in many cases. And everybody's incomes are going down, even the people at the very top. Their incomes are going down. We are getting poorer as a nation. And I attribute this in good part to the disastrous, and I'm being polite using the word disastrous, mistaken policies of the last 33 years that were doubled down on by President Bush and were acquiesced to by Barack Obama. And the people who were elected yesterday, they're in favor of doubling down even more on these policies that must make us worse off over time under just basic economic theory that any Econ 101 student should have learned, including what's known as an accounting identity. Your income is my spending. My spending is your income. If you reduce income, spending has to go down, and that means incomes have to go down.
Before I get to the phones, there's one other point that I think needs to be made here, because I can just hear David's critics, whether you read the comment section online or you could hear them saying, David, if it's true that in 2013 all earners, with the exception of those making $50 million or more, made less, then you need to let the free market work and it'll figure it out. David, you've said on this program many times that the notion of competition would be great if we could actually allow for competition.
Well, I'm a big believer in markets and competition, and I want us to be wealthier. I want to have more people who make million-dollar incomes and more people who have what we call surplus incomes so they can save money. But what we have now are a set of rules that drive down wages. All of our economic competitors have unions. The Germans have unions at the level of executives. The Constitution of Japan requires unions, and that constitution was written by that great American liberal, General Douglas MacArthur, and to those who may be too young to know, that is said very sarcastically, because that's market economics. But when individual workers are confronted with multi-billion dollar employers, they have no bargaining power whatsoever. And they are paid less than their marginal contribution to the market because the market power is on the side of the employers. And to the extent that we have a large number of unemployed people, we continue to push down wages. The very wealthiest people in America would actually be better off if we increased labor compensation. And if all of our competitors have unions, then it makes no sense to argue that we can't stand to have unions. But there's a lot of malarkey that's been sold to people about this. And by the way, I say this as somebody who's both been the founder of a business with 25 workers and would love to have 2,500 workers, and somebody who's been volunteer head of a union and negotiated contracts, as well as studying all these issues all my life.
And by the way, when it comes to this kind of behavior, it's not – we can talk about the impacts of the election last night and et cetera, but it's not a symptom of one – party or the other. And here's an example.
Exactly.
Without looking at the specifics, it's hard for David to on the fly analyze, but in Rochester, Lovely Warren and Maggie Brooks celebrated an announcement working together to get Costco to Citygate, another big box store. Offhand, does that strike you as a win?
Well, Costco is a good employer and they pay better wages. But I think it's very troubling that we are putting money into this. And we're having a little supermarket that's going to open in Cleveland or somewhere in Ohio, and we're giving them like $1 million of training money. You know, this is not market capitalism. This is corporate socialism, and this is where profits are privatized and losses and expenses are socialized. And we do this through a variety of means, and in large part, we don't know about it. I mean, when you have politicians who won't answer questions about what their policies are, You get these kinds of things. When you have journalists who never look at the original data, they just quote what the politicians say in canned statements, you get a very misleading picture of what's going on in the economy.
Our callers have been patient. We're going to take a very short break, and in 60 seconds, we return to the phone lines with David K. Johnston, an investigative reporter and a Pulitzer Prize winner, as we talk about wage disparity, the meaning of the election here and around the country last night, and policy going forward. Short break. Your calls on Connections next. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. David K. Johnston is here, and your calls now. Let me get John in Hilton. John, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Can you define income inequality so that we can understand and follow the calculation?
Oh, sure. Easy to do. Understand that inequality is not about poverty. You can have a deeply unequal society where there is no poverty. And I'll give you a simple measure, and you can go on the internet and find a column I wrote. If you just Google my name, David, C-A-Y, Johnston with a T, and inch and mile. From 1966 to...
Are you going to define it, or are you going to give me an example?
I'm going to give you an example of both, okay?
Okay, great.
I'm going to give you the data from 1966 to 2011, and then I'm going to explain what this means. The average income of the bottom 90% of Americans went up by $59. Not that you'd notice in a year if your income went up or down $59. And if we did that as a chart and made it one inch, the 1% line would be more than 800 feet. And the 1% of the 1%, that group would be 5 miles. Now, inequality is measured by... if everybody had an income that was equal, we would say the inequality measure is zero. If I had all the income and everybody else had no income, it would be one. In the European countries, this is called a Gini index, ranges between about the low 20s in the Nordic countries to a high of around 35 to 40. England, the most unequal country in Europe, is around 40. In the U.S., our Gini in recent years has been as high as 54. That puts us in an area of inequality comparable to Brazil, China, Mexico, Venezuela, and Russia. And it means that the economic gains of the society are being concentrated in very narrow hands. And that's the measure here, is what's the relative gains of people against this measure of the Gini index? It's not the only index, but it's the simplest and easiest one to look at.
John, does that help?
No, I'm still grappling with trying to understand the definition. Do we add up all of the incomes of the world and divide it by... I'm not sure
no,
I follow...
No.
How to do the arithmetic.
Okay. Let me give you two examples to illustrate how inequality works. The minimum wage in this country in 1966, when I was a minimum wage worker, in today's dollars is $11. Do you know what the minimum wage is today? $7.25. So we've reduced the minimum wage by a third. On the other hand, we effectively had a policy in this country prior to 1980 of sort of limiting incomes to the equivalent of about $2 million a year today by having very, very high taxes on incomes above that. And we removed those caps. And now we have numerous people in this country, a couple dozen, who earn $1 billion a year, not a $1 billion fortune, $1 billion a year, that's 500 times what sort of the effective cap was pre-1980. So what's happening is that the distribution of incomes is changing, and more money is being concentrated in the hands of a very narrow group of people at the top. From 2009, when the recession officially ended, to 2012, one-third of all the increased income in the entire United States of over 300 million people went to 31,000 people. One-third to 31,000 people. So inequality is a way to look at how are incomes distributed or broken up across the country. And what we're seeing is very clear. The bottom 90% are going nowhere. The next 9% are having very moderate gains. The bottom half of the top 1% are having some gains, but not a lot. But the top 10th of 1%, the top 100th of 1%, their incomes are going through the roof, and so we're funneling money to those portions of our society.
John, at this point, I hope that that's helped move the needle a little.
I didn't get a definition, but I'll try another time.
Well, thanks. I think you've got an equation. That's more what you were looking for. You see how we sort of calculate. This is Gary in Rochester. Gary, thanks for calling.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
So, Mr. Johnson, this regards both economic policies and how it's related to candidate forums and some of the things that you've spoken about. As we heard the last hour, we had Assemblyman Elect. You know, he stated he went on his promise to repeal the SAFE Act and cutting spending, and a state senator elect went on the same platform. And yet, this very day after the election, they admit they realize the SAFE Act can't be repealed and would accept $1 billion in tax subsidies for Rochester if offered.
Right.
And unfortunately, I just to use that one, but this doesn't seem unusual. One, what do you make of our process where politicians run on platforms they know aren't even possible? And the first question is, would you have any specific remedies to deal with that where you can compel them to accept that platforms? And is it the two-party system that generates the money, or is it the money that sustains the two-party system?
Yeah, let me deal with the second part first. I mean, basically, we have one political party in Washington.
Yeah, thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Gary. We basically have one political party in Washington and in Albany and the other state capitals. It's the party of money. A very, very narrow class of people are putting up the money for the elections. And now with Citizens United, in many cases, we don't even know who those people are that are putting up the money. And, if you got elected to Congress tomorrow, whatever your views are, you're going to have to spend a lot of time pleasing the people who are going to raise the money to either keep you in office or not raise the money to run you out of office. My remedy to all of this is that I think we should really call out politicians who will not submit themselves to questioning by journalists and by citizens in public forums. We just had a senator elected in Iowa who I don't believe ever spoke to a single newspaper reporter. She spoke to a few television reporters in very heavily negotiated circumstances that generally viewers were not told about. And I think if we had people subject to scrutiny, severe, tough scrutiny, it would be better. But we've always had politicians in all parties who will say, whatever gets them elected.
We have a governor who looks at the media class with some kind of scorn in this state. It's very difficult to get access to the governor.
The governor, Mr. DiNapoli, not true of Schneiderman, the attorney general, who's been quite open.
Yep.
And Governor Cuomo, poses as someone who is interested in the welfare of all New Yorkers, and yet he has lied, and I use that word deliberately. He has lied about how his administration, as the previous five administrations have done, protect a narrow class of tax cheats in this state. We've talked on the show before about that. And who, does not hold himself to his own standards of conduct. And I think that's another area we should really get on politicians about. If you say something, we should hold you to your standard you set for yourself.
Well, we talked last week on this program about what real expectations for political leadership means. And I think in this country there is more of a penalty for being wrong than there is for being dishonest. If you're a political leader and you admit that you made a mistake, the press buries you and the voters roll their eyes and say, well, as opposed to if you get caught in a lie, people are so cynical they just expect it now and there is less of a penalty. You agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the people we should honor are people who recognize that a policy they proposed didn't work.
Yeah.
And I'll give an example of a non-politician. There's a man named Pablo Eisenberg who invented what we all know as donor option, where you can take your United Way gift and designate it to a specific charity. And he invented this idea in the late 60s, early 70s, in the expectation that, as he once told me, people who live in Westchester County and go to work in New York City will now provide more money to things like the Boys Club in Harlem. And, of course, they didn't. They designated their money to go to the YMCA in their community in Westchester. And he said, I think it was 1985, he said this was an awful mistake. It's a terrible mistake in policy. It's hurt the poor, who he is a big advocate for. And I think we should pay attention to politicians who say, you know, I was wrong about that, and I've learned, instead of this focus on gaffes and lies and nonsense about, you know, boyfriends or girlfriends that has nothing to do with public behavior.
Yeah, but it makes for good negative ads. Jake writes in asking us about Prop 3, and he says, when it comes to the miseducation of voters, doesn't surprise me that Prop 3 passed yesterday. Before I even get to the rest of his comment, a little aside for our listeners. On Monday, we talked in depth on this program about Prop 3. The education community did not ask the governor or the legislature for this proposition, which funds schools to the tune of $2 billion, essentially one time, if schools spend that money on security or technology or pre-K classroom space. They had a number of complaints. They said, first of all, if you're serious about pre-K, you don't roll it into a technology proposition. Right. Number two, it's bonded. I mean, you're going to be paying for years.
For 30 years, yeah.
For 30 years for so it's not really $2 billion. It's a lot more than that. And we're talking about you're still going to be paying when long after certain equipment is obsolete.
Right.
So, but Jake writes to say, and it passed, by the way, 59-41. School leaders didn't largely come out and support this because they would rather see the state fix the structural funding of education, which they say is much more of a problem than one proposition. Well, Jake writes, you can't say $2 billion to education, throw in the buzzword technology, and not get voters starry-eyed. I'll bet you the amortization terms weren't spelled out on the ballot. Do you know what the specific wording on the ballot was? Well, Jake, you're right. They did not spell out the
amortization, and I frankly didn't even take the time to figure it because it's just an awful proposition. But
it passed, 59-41.
But it passed, and it goes to something really awful about, particularly our state government. The first duty of state government is the education of the young. That is the first duty. And some states have even stronger language than New York does of a what's called first call language. And yet we see that legislators are eager to spend money on everything in the world except that. I voted when I was a Californian to have the lottery in California because I thought people shouldn't have to go to Vegas if they want to gamble. But the argument was it was going to increase public spending. And what did the results show? They just cut public spending on schools from the taxpayers by the amount the lottery brought in. This makes no sense whatsoever. We need to be focused on how do we get an education system that produces the students that we need. And I got to tell you, I have lots of students in my graduate courses in the Law and Business School at Syracuse who come from China, Korea, and Japan. They are so much better educated and so beyond the best American students, with one or two exceptions in the 6 years I've taught there. We should be really scared about that, really scared. We are not being serious about education in this state. And things like this, this proposal is an awful proposal. And I'm surprised it passed, by the way.
Because most voters spend more money and they say no.
Right.
But again, what Jake is saying is you throw technology in schools.
Yeah. No, it was very brilliantly packaged by the advocates for it.
And it is going to get passed and spent. $2 billion, but don't necessarily believe $2 billion. It's going to be more than that. Well, David, again, David K. Johnston writes for Al Jazeera America, and I also read a recent piece from a week ago about safety net programs. And there is a big debate about just how much they do help soften the blow, how much waste, fraud, and abuse, which by now is almost mind-numbingly cliche when people say, oh, they're filled with waste, fraud, and abuse. Do they actually do anything? David took the time to look into the impact of safety net programs for his column last week. What did you find?
The per capita income, per person income in the United States from 2000 to 2012, as reported on tax returns, fell by a little over $1,000. If it wasn't for Social Security, unemployment benefits, and pensions, traditional defined benefit pensions, both private and government, the fall would have been $2,200. Not $1,000 a person, but $2,200. If that had happened, we would be in a, not a recession, we'd be back in a depression. We would be in vastly worse shape. Corporate profits would be falling instead of going through the roof. Companies would be laying people off left and right. Demand for government services would be going through the roof. And by the way, waste, fraud, and abuse. The Washington Post did this huge piece about on the Sunday front page about how the government sent checks, Social Security checks, to people who died. You know, you're not, your check's supposed to be cut off when you die. And it worked out to be something like literally 0.0000006% of government spending. These programs are well, Social Security is very well-run program with very low overhead that's very efficient. And as I said earlier, 73% of Republicans want to increase it. The safety net is necessary because of the society we lived in. When we lived in an agrarian society, we didn't need to have a safety net. But corporate America, to prosper, needs people to pick up and leave and move their job from here to there. And we don't have houses anymore that support multi-generational families, for by and large. And so you need to have, if you're going to have that, a safety net. And our safety net's being frayed and destroyed and worsened. And a number of the people elected office, you know, their promise is they're going to get rid of Social Security because we should trust the market. People should save for their old age. Well, what are we going to do with people who didn't save or who invested in the wrong things and lost? They did it right. They did everything they should do, and then they lost everything in some poor investment choices in their old age. You know, are we going to tax ourselves then to support them? Are we going to shoot them? You know, there's a reason every modern society has a safety net.
Interestingly enough, Megan McArdle, who writes about economics from really a more libertarian perspective for a number of publications, wrote about exactly this phenomenon. She said, really with the baby boomers, it's all coalescing at this fascinating time. People are living longer by decades than they did two generations ago. So you get people living longer, but they're farther apart than they've ever been. Plenty of people, parents and grandparents, are getting older and they don't have family near them.
Right.
So all of a sudden, we have to decide how are we going to pay for their care and what services.
Yeah. Life expectancy, though, has not gone up. I mean, one of the things problems I have with Megan's stuff is she doesn't really carefully study the data.
Life expectancy?
No, life expectancy at the year 1900, if you were a white male, you were born in 1900, was 53 years. At the year 2000, it was 73 years. Life expectancy has increased since Social Security began, but only by about a dozen years.
Okay.
I mean, that's great. I wish it would be longer. And there is a problem that our pension funding, private pensions and business pensions, government pensions have assumed a lifespan that's turning out to be short, especially for better paid workers. But it hasn't gone up by decades. It's only gone up by decades if your measurement point is 1900 or 1800.
But certainly now, we do have, to David's point is absolutely on the money, that we are farther apart than ever.
Right.
So this notion of, you know, investing on your own, taking care of yourself, conservatives will say, David, shouldn't there be a penalty, though? If that's your money and you're making a decision and you invest in something that goes bust, that's you've got to own
sure.
it.
Sure. But on the other hand, let's remember the fundamental point about economics that was taught to us by Adam Smith, specialization. And if you're going to say everybody should invest their own money, well, then maybe you should operate on yourself. There's an ad on TV that's exactly that. Well, a doctor says, you know, take your knife out and cut below this rib. Most people don't know how to invest. They are never going to learn how to invest. That's why we have specialists who do that. And the data shows that pension plans lose less when markets go down and make more when markets go up than ordinary investors. A lot more.
All right, let me grab Harry in Rochester, who's been waiting. Go ahead, Harry.
David, can you please explain why you are and remain a registered Republican?
Sure. First of all, where I live, the only interesting primaries are Republican. And secondly, the Republicans keep saying they're the party of the big tent. Well, I'm a Teddy Roosevelt sort of guy, and so they should be thrilled to have me.
Okay.
That answer your question, Harry?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks for calling. for those who I suspect, I don't know if Harry is indicating that he doesn't think David is sort of a genuine conservative or Republican, the bottom line is there's plenty of conversation this hour that isn't very palatable to Democrats in power either.
Well, and let me be clear. I mean, I'm very conservative about some things. I teach in my courses, you know, virtues that go back thousands of years. But I'm also progressive. I believe we should make a better world and that we should use science and our knowledge to do things. And when we make mistakes, we should recognize that and correct them. But I don't believe in a society that essentially is designed to protect the already rich and their fortunes. And that's what we're building. We're building moats. I mean, Warren Buffett writes about this, building moats around fortunes and creating companies that have a regulatory moat so nobody can compete against them and they can charge high prices and make outsized profits. And I don't believe in that. I believe in competitive markets. Now, someday, you know, we get to a Star Trek world where you walk up to a machine and say, tea, Earl Grey hot, and it even knows what cup you want. Maybe we won't need competitive markets. But at this point, the best thing human beings have come up with is pricing and competitive markets. But people game the system. So the government's job should be to do, as the Germans do, they call it ordoliberalism, constantly try to make sure the playing field is pushed back to as level as you can get it. And what we're doing now is actively tilting the playing field in favor of the political donor class.
Picking winners and losers,
that's
and it's
right.
often the donor class. We're going to get back to the phones here. By the way, David mentioned science and reason. With Republicans controlling the U.S. Senate, the head of the Environmental Committee is now Jim Inhofe.
Who is
one of the most ardent
climate change is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated.
He is now leading the committee
right.
on the environment.
And every Republican on the House Science Committee believes essentially the same thing. And this should be very troubling to us that we're not, democracy requires reason and empirical facts. And we can have lots of disagreements about the nature of global climate change, but among, you know, the overwhelming majority of scientists, there's no disagreement about what's going on. There's a lot of disagreement about what we do about it.
What we can and should.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the policy. But if you don't like the policy of can and should, you don't get to go back and say it's not happening.
Denial is not a good policy.
Well, there you are. Let's get to Pete. Thanks for calling. Pete, you're on with David K. Johnston.
Good afternoon. The results and voter apathy are not surprising. I would suggest you go take a look at the Princeton Dartmouth study, U.S. No Longer a Democracy.
Yeah.
Secondly, David, enjoy when you come on, look forward to your appearances, and I would ask that you describe the tax codes of the federal and state governments in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, the various tiers and the percentages, because people in this country have been convinced that taxes are a problem.
Right. Well, Pete, we are the least taxed of the modern countries of the world. We are not, therefore, reinvesting in the future. I mean, that's a big part of what's going wrong here is we're not investing in the future. We're not building highways and repairing the ones we have and bridges and doing basic science research, which corporations cannot fund because the returns are not to any one corporation.
Go ahead, Pete.
But describe, tell us about the tax rate.
The highest marginal tax rate was 91%, and it was on investment income. And as best I can tell, the only person who ever actually paid that rate was Ronald Reagan, and I take his word that he paid it. Everybody else went out and bought tax shelters to pay a lower rate. We have radically reduced taxes on the top 400 and the top 1% in America. And the tax rates paid by the vast majority of Americans today are the same or slightly higher, depending on where you fall in the income chain, as they were back in the 1960s. I haven't done the 50s on that, but I have done as far back as 1966.
All right. And Charles wants to know, have you settled on a rate that you think we and David himself should be paying?
No, I think that the rates we pay are political decisions. Remember, we live in the Second American Republic, and we created this republic because the first one failed because it lacked two key powers. It couldn't regulate trade and it couldn't tax. And that's a political decision about what tax rates are appropriate. I will tell you this, on corporate taxes, the higher the corporate tax rate, the more big corporations like this. And if you want to understand that, read my Newsweek cover story from 2 months ago called Corporate Deadbeats. The trick is to earn your profits in a high-tax country and take them in a zero-tax country, and then you make above-normal global profits. And it's called stateless income. And trust me, corporations love high tax rates if they're multinational.
Jane, you're on with David K. Johnston. Go ahead.
Yes. What I want is to see another Harry Truman or an FDR, so I am disappointed. FDR used to call the Republicans royalists. They think of themselves as being royal and above any democracy, any sort of restraints. and we can talk about all the various details, but basically what I'm displeased with is that the Democrats do not stand up enough. There's no backbone. I feel that with Obama. I feel that with Cuomo. He won't stand up against fracking. I mean, how long have we been talking about this? 5 years, 6 years? And Obama is pro-fracking. I don't want to see it in this state. It will destroy our state. And yet they cannot say that. I want us to stand up and be adults with these people and call them out for what they are. They are against democracy and the masses being a party to the laws that we have to obey. I want Harry Truman, people that are not ashamed to say what they feel.
Thank you, Jane. Go ahead, David.
Thank you, Jane. Well, I'm not sure fracking will destroy the state. I mean, you have to weigh off fracking against the damage from coal, but and other options that we could have. But you know, look, the Democrats raise their money from the same people as the Republicans. It's a very narrow class of people. I mean, ask yourself as a listener, when's the last time you made a significant contribution to a politician? I don't mean $25 or $100. I mean a significant contribution or bundled up $100,000 for somebody. We have created a nightmare where politicians have to listen to the moneyed class, and there's a left and right wing within the party, but it's one party, the party of money.
I've got less than a minute. You've been following at all what Larry Lessig is doing and trying to reshape. He's a Harvard law professor who has created a pact to end PACs. His goal is to get the money influence out of politics, but he says it's very possible that this is not going to work, that right now money is so entrenched that any kind of real reform is almost impossible.
My hope is that we end up with such awful people elected to office because of the secret money in this terrible Citizens United. It's our Dred Scott and Plessy Ferguson of our time, that people then wake up about this. But it's hard to be optimistic because of the level of apathy and the disconnect people see in their lives. But, you know, we can fix any problem we have if we decide to do so. And that's the real issue here. Do we as America want to continue going down the path to lower incomes, which is where we've been going for a long time, and more concentrated wealth? Or do we want to have a vibrant, healthy society that's on the cutting edge of both promoting freedom and economic growth?
The hour ends and the phones are still ringing. That means, will you come back again soon, David?
Sure, anytime.
David K. Johnston, you can find his work, some really remarkable stuff in Newsweek. One of these days, I just want to talk about some of the really outstanding stuff you've done, sort of rewriting biographies in Newsweek that I've really enjoyed.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a subject for another day. Al Jazeera America as well online. David K. Johnston, an investigative reporter, and we appreciate his time. Roger, great job as an engineer today. I'm Evan Dawson. Thank you for listening on Connections on member-supported public radio.